I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. When he wasn't playing with the likes of Charlie Parker, Billie Holiday, Miles Davis, and just about every other jazz great, or leading his own groups, Billy Taylor has been doing other things. He wrote books, got a doctorate in education, worked for NPR, PBS, CBS, and at the Kennedy Center. He's even starred in a few TV commercials. And next week, he makes his official return to public performance, playing with his trio at the Blue Note from June 24th to the 29th. In addition, his label Soundpost has released two CDs, is preparing a third one. It is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. William Edward Taylor Jr. to my show today. Hi. When was the last time anybody called you that?
It's been a while.
First of all, how is your health? Everything
fine,
okay?
Fine. I feel very good now. Things are shaping up, and I'm practicing and really trying to play as well as I feel.
Because a stroke sometimes slows down one of your hands, and you've always been a piano with a lot of technique.
Well, thank you. It was hard to get started again because I thought that, you know, after I had laid on my back for a minute, I'd just get up and start go right to the piano, you know. Didn't quite work that way.
You had to retrain yourself?
To a little bit. One of the things that I have to do is my left hand is fine. But my right hand, it was on my right side. So on the right side, I have to do things that really focused, and I have to really work at it.
Well, most jazz pianists, at least in the modern jazz tradition, really rely on their right hand a lot more than their left hand. Although you had that locked hand style also.
Yeah.
Influenced by Milt Bruckner?
Yeah, it was very much. He was the first one I ever heard do that, and I wanted to play like that. I heard
forgotten by many people.
Yeah, I heard him play Nola. You know that thing? And he played it locked. I said, "What is he doing?" You
know, with both hands.
With both hands, man. This is when he was with Lionel Hampton, man. I mean, he was awesome.
Your major influence was Art Tatum, wasn't he?
Oh yeah. Well, Art was my mentor. I mean, he was the one that I always wanted to emulate to the best of my ability because he was special.
On the other hand, many would-be pianists were scared off just watching him.
I was fortunate. I met Art on the first gig that I had in New York. I was playing with Ben Webster on 52nd Street. And
At the Deuces, right?
At the Three Deuces. Right, yeah.
So you started with Ben Webster. That's pretty much starting at the top.
Tell me about it. I was lucky. I mean, this was back in, during the Second World War. And a lot of the good piano players were in the Army or Armed Forces. And he needed a piano player. And luckily I was around and I got the gig.
Were you already aware of the changes that were going on in jazz at that time?
Very much so. I had heard Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker with Earl Hines Band in Washington, D.C., where I grew up. And as a matter of fact, I had been introduced to one of the legendary young guys of that time, whose name was Little Benny. And he introduced me to Diz and Bird, and he said, you know, these guys are really doing some different things here in Earl Hines' band. And since he was already in Earl Hines' band, I was listening to what he was saying. I said, well, let me check them out, you know. And the first time I heard Charlie Parker, I didn't like him. Because he was playing tenor in that particular engagement, and I love what Dizzy was doing because he was fiery and doing all this stuff. But I was really into Ben Webster then, and so Parker was doing some other stuff, and I don't know, it was okay, but I didn't catch it.
Well, I've heard some records of him playing on tenor. He sounds like an alto player playing on tenor. He didn't have a distinctive sound.
No, he didn't.
You had gone to college, actually. You came to New York straight out of college. Was it typical for a jazz musician in the early 40s to have a college degree?
Well, it was for me because I came from a family which was educationally oriented. My mother was a teacher. My father was a dentist. I was growing up in Washington, D.C., and the people that were all around me were... I lived about a block from Howard University, so I was... it was just ordained that I would go to someplace.
And even after you were very well known, you went and got your PhD.
That was way later.
Yeah, in 1975. You've probably done as much as anyone in jazz history to foster an awareness and understanding and appreciation of jazz to the general public. Do you think that comes out of your own experiences with education?
Definitely. I was really amazed when I first got to know many of the musicians on 52nd Street. I realized that that generation of musicians really was a hands-on generation. They taught me. They taught many, many people. But it was do as I say do, or check this out. Look at what I'm doing. Or it was really hands-on learning. And having studied, I had a Bachelor of Science in music. And music teaching, actually, and so it just seemed to me that it could be done better. And at that particular time, I was actually studying piano, and my then piano teacher encouraged me. He said, "Well, you know, why don't you share some of this knowledge that you have in terms of the touch that you have to use, and the various things that you do." With some of them, because they'd profit by what you do.
Well, not only other musicians, but with the general public. And it's my sense that if more musicians were willing to share some of their insights, that more people might have some kind of be able to connect to jazz, which seems
right
like
now,
almost like a foreign language to kids today.
But today, more people are. More of the people that you and I know are really teaching. Many of them are really teaching right here in this area. I'm really delighted that so many musicians who I talked to a lot of my friends years ago, and they just refused. They said, "No, I'm a player. I don't want to teach, and I don't want to do this and that." But now it's a different frame of reference. And many of the guys in my generation have begun to teach and have been sharing this wonderful knowledge that they have with a lot of people who are deserving.
Have you tried out the Steinway that's behind you?
Yeah, a little bit.
It's a very nice piano, isn't
it? It is, very.
Would you like to play a little bit for us?
Sure, okay.
What are you going to play?
I don't know.
Okay. We have Billy Taylor walking over to the piano to play I Don't Know. Actually, Monk probably would have called a tune I Don't Know.
Thank you.
I couldn't tell that you were recovering from anything. You have also recovered your touch. That probably is the hardest thing for a pianist to get.
It is. One of the things that I was very interested in was to get the kind of sound that I've always gotten, and because I work very hard to try to get it. Much of that comes from Tatum, but it also comes from studying with Richard McClanahan, who was a wonderful teacher and taught the Tobias Matthay system of touch tone control. And so I'm very indebted to both of them.
You talked about how when you started, much of the learning was hands-on. You played with somebody who then told you something. And you played with Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Machito, Don Redman, Artie Shaw, Slam Stewart, a wide range of musicians. I'm sure you had to adjust to each of them, but did you learn from all of them?
I learned from each one, something from just about everybody I ever worked with, because those guys were so original, and they were telling personal stories. I mean, it was as Lester Young used to say, and really when I played with Ben Webster, I was going to school every night learning how to play ballads. Mm-hmm. He played the most gorgeous ballads of anybody I ever worked with.
He said he always kept the words in mind. He actually thought of the words while he was playing. Can you do the same thing while you're playing
a
ballad?
No. I write words and can't even remember the ones I write. I think a little differently when I'm playing melodies. And I try to think melodically no matter what I'm playing.
Well, you were the house pianist at Birdland for some years, so that had to be an education in itself. Then you hired some pretty great musicians. Charlie Mingus used to be your bass player.
Yeah, in the first trio that I was able to keep afloat for a while was right after I left Birdland, and he was my bassist, and he was wonderful to play. He was a fantastic. People really, right now, think of him basically as a composer, but he was one of the greatest bass players I ever played with.
Always in tune.
Yeah, always.
Your current trio, Chip Jackson on bass, Wernard Harper on drums, who you'll be at Birdland with.
We'll be at
Blue Note, I'm
Blue
sorry.
Note, yeah. I used to be at Birdland.
And there is a new Birdland. And also John Faddis is joining you?
Yeah, I'm really delighted. John used to sit in with me when I was the musical director of the David Frost show. And he is such fun to play with. I mean, he's just, this guy's got a sense of humor unlike anybody. Maybe Dizzy Gillespie, but he's special.
So you mostly had trios, but then you had that big orchestra with the David Frost show. That was the 70s. What would you prefer? Do you like the trio setting best?
Yeah, I prefer to play in trios. But right now, because I haven't done it in a long time, there are a lot of things I'd like to do with horn players, like John and others, because I hear things in what they do that just intrigue me.
Well, jazz is really a dialogue, a conversation, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But you've also been a great speaker over the years, and you've had a wonderful career in broadcasting. You could just have had a career in broadcasting. You had a daily show on WLIB, and I remember you were even the station manager there for a while. You had a weekly show here on NPR. You've done a lot of stuff on television. The Charles Kuralt CBS Sunday Morning, you were the arts correspondent there, won a bunch of Emmys.
Yeah.
Was playing just not enough for you?
No, I just wanted to do a lot of different things. I wanted to be involved in spreading the word as far as jazz was concerned. I really feel that we have given jazz a short shrift, and we have not done, as a culture, the kinds of things that would serve out own best interests. For instance, I've traveled all over the world for the State Department and for in concerts and doing things in other places that I would never visit as a tourist. But I've been sent to some of these places, and it was really wonderful to find out in Russia and in other places, Budapest like that, how much people knew about indigenous jazz and things that were really, I thought, based solely here in the States. And I found gypsies and Russians and people who just really spoke the language without accent.
You've founded a festival for women in jazz. Do you think that the gender gap in jazz is finally narrowing a bit, at least for piano players, if not anyone else?
It's narrowing quite a bit for the women that we've been able to present at the Kennedy Center. And I'm really proud of that, because for the last 7 years, we've been able to present a whole bunch of women that would not have gotten that kind of attention had we not done that. And I think it's way overdue. I'm really just adamant about the fact that so many of the women that we've identified that play so beautifully still don't get the kind of opportunities to play as those of us who are male.
Well, most of them have been on the piano, although even going back to the 30s, it was Vlada Snow, who played trumpet incredibly well. Mm-hmm. There have been a whole bunch of other people, but they've generally been excluded because this is an all-male world, isn't it?
Yeah, but the women have banged the door down. I mean, the women that we've got some drummers that are, you know, pretty
Cindy
mean.
Black,
I mean, they really have presented people at the Kennedy Center that just wiped everybody out with their fire and spirit that they have. And so it's just a baseless way to go to keep them from doing what they should do.
And we have the new album, Urban Griot.
Griot.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I mispronounced that.
It's a French word, but it urban. The griot is from African from the African tradition. It was a teacher and a healer and someone who did something very special. And I try to do as many of those things.
I would call you a griot. You're also, as I said, at the Blue Note from the 24th to the 29th. Thank you so much for being with us. It's good to see you looking so well.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.